Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, it's 6 a.m. in Beijing, 3 p.m. in Los Angeles, and 6 p.m. here in Atlanta. I'm Linda Kincaid. And wherever you are in the world, this is your First Move. A warm welcome to First Move. Here's your need to know. Held in contempt, Donald Trump is fined at his hush money trial for violating a gag order and threatened with jail time if he does it again. The former president says it's unconstitutional and calls the trial ridiculous. Campus clashes. Classes are canceled at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and students occupying a building at Columbia University are threatened with expulsion. And men set to make their first move. Dating app Bumble opens the door to men starting conversations on the platform. All that and much more coming up. But first, the latest on Donald Trump's hush money trial. Keith Davidson, a former lawyer for Stormy Daniels and Carrie McDougal, testified about how their deals were done, saying interest in the adult film star's story reached a crescendo when the infamous Access Hollywood tape came out. Earlier Tuesday, the judge fined Trump $9,000 for violating his gag order. After that ruling, Trump moved the 9 social media posts that had got him in trouble. And the judge also threatened the former president with jail time if he keeps violating those orders. Here's what Donald Trump had to say after the court adjourned.
This gag order is not only unique, it's totally unconstitutional. I'm the Republican candidate for president of the United States. I received this honor in record time. Nobody's ever gone faster. It's never happened. Nobody's ever got the numbers that we got. And I'm sitting in a courthouse.
Our Kara Scannell has the details.
On the stand, the ex-lawyer for 2 women, a Playboy model and adult film star, at the center of former President Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial. Attorney Keith Davidson testified on Tuesday, revealing new details about the deal at the crux of the prosecution's case, a $130,000 payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels to kill a story on an alleged affair with Trump weeks before the 2016 election. Davidson represented Daniels in the arrangement, selling the story to Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen. Trump denies having an affair with Daniels. Prosecutors have alleged that Trump did not want to write the check, so Cohen put up the money on his behalf after Cohen confirmed Trump would pay him back. Davidson testified the release of the Access Hollywood tape in October 2016 sparked tremendous interest in her story. The National Enquirer editor Dylan Howard texts Davidson that her story would be the end for Trump's campaign. Davidson texts Howard, "Trump is effed. Wave the white flag. It's over, people." Howard responded to Davidson's text. Howard said in a text, "Yeah, but her talking and taking is the final nail in the coffin, but he's effed already." After Cohen missed the deadline to wire the money multiple times, Davidson testified he believed Cohen was stalling on the deal. Davidson said he told Cohen, "I don't believe a word, really, that you say." Cohen responded, "God damn it, what do you expect me to do? My guy is in 5 different states today." And Davidson told him of his client's unhappiness, recalling Cohen told him, "God damn it, I'll just do it myself." Davidson told the jury, "I thought he was trying to kick the can down the road until after the election." Earlier in the day, the jury heard from Michael Cohen's former banker, Gary Farrow, who testified about Cohen's scramble to open and fund an account in late October of 2016. Farrow revealed he did not know Cohen's payment was being made to an adult film star or that it was related to political activity. If he had, he testified, it would have required a much longer review and potentially would not have opened the account. Davidson also represented former Playboy model Karen McDougal, who alleged a nearly year-long romantic affair with Trump, which Trump also denies. Prosecutors asked Davidson about the agreement to sell McDougal's story to the Inquirer, which was ultimately sold to the tabloid's parent company for $150,000 and buried before the election. Davidson texts Howard in June 2016, "I have a blockbuster Trump story." Howard texts back, "Talk first thing. I will get you more than anyone for it. You know why." Days later, Howard responded again, asking, "Did he cheat on Melania?" Davidson testified there was an unspoken understanding that the Inquirer bought her story to bury it because of a close affiliation between the tabloid's publisher and Trump, and that AMI would not run this story or any story related to Karen and Donald Trump because it would tend to hurt Donald Trump. While Davidson testified about McDougal and Daniels, Trump's son Eric Trump sat in the front row of the gallery listening. He is the first family member of Trump's to attend the trial. And court began with Judge Juan Merchan handing down a much-anticipated ruling, saying Donald Trump violated the gag order that prevents him from discussing witnesses in the case 9 times. Trump was fined $9,000 total, $1,000 per violation.
For more on this, former Florida Judge Jeff Swartz joins me. He's also a professor at Cooley Law School. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good evening.
So, Professor, we heard that the judge ruled that Trump had violated his gag order 9 times. He was fined $9,000 and also threatened with jail time should he do it again. Under what circumstances would this 77-year-old former president face jail time for violating a gag order again?
Well, as a former judge, I can tell you that you don't put a threat like that on a piece of paper and an order and not be able to carry through with it. So the judge has put himself in a position that if Mr. Trump continues to willingly and defy the orders of the court, he's placed himself in a position where he can do nothing less than some sort of incarceration, even if it's for a few hours or overnight or whatever it may be, to let Mr. Trump know that now you have been incarcerated. If you do it again, it's going to get even worse. He has to do something if, in fact, Trump defies him. And that's really the circumstances under which the judge would do that.
And, of course, Donald Trump claims that this gag order violates his right to free speech, does it?
No, it does not. The First Amendment is not absolute. And, in fact, there are terms and conditions, and it's based upon a reasonableness standard, that you can, in fact, stop someone from speaking, whether it's slander or libel or yelling fire in a crowded theater or doing things that are meant to threaten a witness or a juror in a case. The key here is that Mr. Trump doesn't understand that he's not just a former president of the United States. He is a defendant in a criminal case, and he has to comply like every other defendant does.
And of course, today we heard from the former lawyer of adult film star Stormy Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal. Keith Davidson testified, speaking about the negotiations to sell the women's stories to the National Enquirer. What did you make as him as far as witnesses go?
Well, first of all, based upon what I've been able to observe, he was very candid and very truthful, it seems. The state tried desperately to get him to tie what Mr. Cohen was doing to Mr. Trump. Those questions were objected to as speculative, and they were sustained. Now, this is something that's going to be brought out by the defense. They're going to say, you never spoke to Mr. Trump. You don't know that Mr. Trump told Mr. Cohen to do this. You only know this because this is what Mr. Cohen told you. And under those circumstances, he can't tie all of this to Mr. Trump. They're still leaving it basically up to Mr. Cohen to be able to convince the jury that he did everything he did for Mr. Trump. And that's really where the crux of the matter is right now. What happened and who got paid and how much, that seems to be a done deal. There's no way to contest that. The question is, did Mr. Trump ask Mr. Cohen to do this? And was it done for the purpose of interfering with the election?
And that is key, Professor, isn't it? Because the alleged affairs are not illegal. The hush money is not illegal. But of course, if these payments were intended to hide details from voters before the 2016 election, that, of course, violates the campaign finance law, right?
That's correct. And in what the state has tried to do, and we've seen this in their opening and in other places, they're trying to establish there is a conspiracy among a number of people to have all this money transferred to pay these women off in order to protect Mr. Trump's election bid. Now, you don't have to do something that's illegal to be participating in a conspiracy. All you have to do is agree to do it for the stated purpose. If I ask you to go out and buy a car for me so I can go rob a bank and I will have a getaway car, buying a car is not an illegal act. But doing it in furtherance of the conspiracy, that is to rob the bank, that makes it an overt act and that makes you part of the conspiracy.
Professor Jeff Swartz, good to get you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Have a nice night.
You too. I want to turn to college campuses across the U.S. where we have seen chaos, confrontation, and at times clashes with authorities. New York's Columbia University, pro-Palestinian protesters have barricaded themselves inside a university building, waving the Palestinian flag from its rooftop. The university says those inside now face expulsion. It is advising people to stay away from the main campus. And there are soaring tensions at other colleges too. Dozens of people arrested at the University of Texas at Austin and at Virginia Tech after refusing to disperse.
We're going this way. You guys have closed the entrance. We are UCLA students. I have my ID right here.
In California, this Jewish student shared this video of him being blocked from entering part of the UCLA campus by protesters. U.S. President Joe Biden is condemning what he calls a ferocious surge of anti-Semitism nationwide. In North Carolina, the situation turned physical with police pushing back protesters. Dozens of demonstrators were detained there. Wow, Diane Gallagher is at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill and joins us now live. So, Diane, good to have you with us. This university is certainly the latest to cancel classes there. Just talk to us about how police have been responding today, because we certainly saw tensions rising.
And I will say that at this very moment, tensions are at a very low point. Linda, you can kind of look and see behind me. At this point, you have maintenance workers for the university with police watching on, erecting a fence. So no longer just barricades around this flagpole that's sort of become a flashpoint this afternoon of this protest, when several of the protesters took the American flag down, put the Palestinian flag up on this flagpole. That's when police sort of came into the situation. The protesters had arms entwined around the flagpole. The officers who responded to that began pushing down and pulling down the protesters. The protesters then were beginning to throw water bottles in kind. We watched several of them hit the officers during that moment there. They then took the Palestinian flag down, tried to put the American flag back up. It was taken back down by a protester. And you can see now they are sort of attempting to make it to where there's a man who brought his own flag and tried to put it up, but sort of attempting to make this less accessible right now. You can probably see behind me, it's a very small crowd. The majority of them are media and a few students just hanging around, very different than what we had earlier this afternoon around 2, 3, 4 p.m. That was the most tense that we witnessed. We do know that this morning students said that there were violent arrests when their encampment was swept by university and police officials around 6 a.m. But at the moment, it is calm here at the University of North Carolina. Linda, we have seen a significant increase in police presence, as well as riot gear with police bringing them into staging areas, and just a significant increase in the number of officers here on campus as well.
All right, Diane Gallagher at the University of North Carolina. Good to have you there on the scene for us. Thanks so much. I want to turn now to Julia Vargas-Jones, who's at Columbia University. Good to have you there, Julia. So we know that people are occupying the campus building. Even the White House responded, saying this is the wrong approach. We know those students have been threatened with expulsion. Are police also threatening charges?
Yeah, Linda, so behind me here, you see this small protest from students and mostly from a crowd from the outside. But this is the only entrance for Columbia University right now. I'm going to take you on a little bit of a tour, and I'll get to your question shortly. The big question looming over campus now is, will Columbia call in the New York Police Department again to help clear out the protesters? The big reason they did that to begin with is that, you see right here, we're starting to get the setup for commencement, graduation. This is a big moment for Columbia, for any university. They're expecting hundreds, about 15,000 people are supposed to graduate in just a couple of weeks, and this is the state of campus. Over here, we still have tents set up from almost 2 weeks ago, Linda. So this is causing so much mayhem at Columbia's campus that they can't start really setting up for graduation right now. We haven't really shown much of how the rest of campus is doing, but I will turn around and show you the building where students are still barricaded. As of 2 p.m. yesterday, that's the encampment that students and protesters were supposed to vacate. That didn't happen. That deadline came and went. That's when you saw the protests escalate, and now moving on to Hamilton Hall. I'm going to show you how the situation is here now. A few dozen students have been barricaded inside this building. This is the building where historically there have been protests at Columbia against the Vietnam War, against apartheid in South Africa. So there is a lot of meaning behind the choice of this building for students to occupy. At around 12:30 last night, there was a human chain of staff, faculty, students, and protesters. We don't know if all the people that are inside are Columbia students. We know some of them are. We have no idea how many there are. They're not really talking to media. Every time I've tried and ask a few questions, I'm told, we're not talking to media. Please don't film me. I am only allowed on campus because I am a student and I have my student ID. Right now, if I were to leave and come back, I would not be allowed in. Now it's only students who live on campus and those who have essential staff positions that need to be here. But as you can see, it's all still barricaded. These were all of the patio furniture that's usually around other parts of the lawn that was all pushed up here. There's chairs inside, zip ties, and there's a pulley system, which is now not here, but this is how students and supporters of the pro-Palestinian protesters have been getting food, water, and coffee up to students up here. And there's a brand new encampment. We haven't shown this yet either. Some of the tents that were on the other side of the lawn were brought here today, just actually a couple hours ago. And like I said, the big question that we're facing is, what does Columbia do now? They've already said that students that are inside here are facing expulsion, but how do they get them out, Linda? I think that's the question that President of Columbia University, Manu Shafiq, is trying to wrestle with right now.
Yeah, certainly a lot of people waiting with bated breath to see what that response will entail. Julia Vargas-Jones, good to have you with us. Thanks so much. Well, still to come, you are going to get your up-to-the-minute weather forecast, plus India's general election taking place amid dangerous tensions between the country's Muslim and Hindu populations, many pointing the finger at Prime Minister Narendra Modi for making the situation worse. We'll have a special report. Plus, a few clouds in Amazon's just-released results, the tech giant surpassing first-quarter expectations thanks to ad sales and cloud computing growth. All those details when we come back.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back to First Move. I'm Linda Kincaid. In today's Money Move, a rough way to close out the month of April on Wall Street. All the major averages fell by well over 1%. The Nasdaq tumbled more than 2%. And you can blame it on a hotter-than-expected read on U.S. labor costs that raised new inflationary concerns. And all this before the Fed's updated inflationary outlook and policy statement on Wednesday. Well, McDonald's also warning that consumers are pulling back on spending due to higher prices. Starbucks shares are tumbling more than 12% in after-hours trading after reporting slowing sales as well. And in Asia, the major averages finished April trading mostly higher. The Shanghai Composite was the exception amid a disappointing read on Chinese factory activity. Well, in other business news, Amazon is the latest big tech firm to report strong first quarter results. The company's shares are up about 2% in after-hours trading on news that Q1 profits tripled to more than $10 billion. Amazon CEO calling it, quote, a good start to the year. Not a bad start at all. Paul LaMonica joins me now. He's a senior markets analyst, writer at Barron's. Good to have you with us, Paul. So Amazon investors should be happy. Really strong results across the board.
Yeah, obviously, Linda, you know, very, very solid numbers for Amazon, not just in the consumer retail business, but with AWS, their massive cloud hosting business, that's getting a lift from artificial intelligence, generative AI, a big driver of growth. And then advertising, keep in mind that Amazon recently has started to advertise, have advertisements and ad revenue on Prime Video. So that is another new revenue stream for Amazon. And revenue in advertising was up nearly 25% in the quarter.
I mean, that's just incredible, isn't it? I mean, ad sales this year in the US, with it being an election year, it's no surprise that ad sales in general are up. But that's quite a significant result, really.
Yeah, it is, especially when you consider that Amazon is a relatively new player to advertising, stepping up its ad game so that it can be a little bit more competitive with the likes of other giants like Facebook owner Meta Platforms and Google and YouTube parent Alphabet. Those two, you know, continue to obviously control the lion's share of digital ad growth, but Amazon is catching up very rapidly.
And of course, it's really pushing, right, to infuse AI across all its online businesses, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think that AI is a particularly big driver of growth in AWS, the cloud business, having, you know, independent smaller sellers that use AWS have the ability to use AI to have better listings and better search results, and that drives more sales and more revenue for those companies, as well as Amazon, obviously. So a big part of the ecosystem now, and I think Amazon, proving that AI is not just for the hardware companies like NVIDIA that have benefited from the strong adoption of artificial intelligence.
Amazon CEO, no doubt, will be celebrating tonight. Paul LaMonica, good to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, for weeks, Kenya has struggled with heavy flooding. More than 170 people have been killed, dozens are missing, and close to 200,000 Kenyans have been forced to leave their homes, with Nairobi County being the worst hit. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Chad Myers. I mean, how's the situation looking there right now, Chad?
Linda, another 150 millimeters of rain coming down in the next 48 to 72 hours. That's 6 inches. On top of the 27 inches of rain that Nairobi has picked up just in April alone. So today was a fairly dry day, but the waters obviously aren't still going down, because if it's in the mountains, all of that water has to run down into the city before it finally goes away. 694 millimeters. Get out a meter stick and see where 694 is. 69 centimeters of rainfall anywhere will cause flooding. But there were places in Kenya, this big square right here, that were 400% of normal just for this month alone. We expect it. This is when the big heavy rainfall comes in the middle of the spring when the intertropical convergence zone is right over the top. And then later on, by June, it's all gone. And it doesn't rain at all. But here is the problem. They had too much too fast, and still more coming down. More coming down everywhere that you see yellow, that's at least 50. Some spots, 150 more millimeters. So that's another 6 inches of rainfall still to come down. In America, we're seeing our chance of severe weather again today with tornado watches still posted. And they'll go on till about 11 o'clock tonight in places. Already had one tornado on the ground officially in Kansas. Saw some pictures of that on a YouTube live stream here. But more storms tomorrow again. This is just the time of year when America gets the severe weather. Hail, wind, and of course, yes, the tornadoes. There's been more than 120 tornadoes just in the past 5 days or so. So here goes the rainfall for parts of China as well, right where we don't want it. The same story we've been talking about, Linda. This is just a broken record. One day after another of 100 millimeters, 4 inches of rainfall, and then another day, and then it breaks for a couple days, and then it's back. This is just kind of a pattern we're all stuck in right now.
Soggy spring. Yeah. All right, Tab Myers, good to get that update. Staying across it all. Thank you. We are going to take a quick break. We have much more news on First Move in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to First Move. I'm Linda Kincaid with a look at more international headlines this hour. Well, large groups of protesters in Tbilisi, Georgia, have clashed with police outside the country's parliament throughout the night there. Demonstrators are angry over the so-called foreign agents bill, which would require organizations to declare funding sources from outside of Georgia. Critics say the bill would hurt the country's bid to join the European Union. Haiti's Transitional Council has proposed a new interim prime minister. Fritz Belizaire is the country's former sports minister. The council is responsible for setting up elections with the goal of eventually handing over power to a new president. Haiti has faced waves of violence and unrest since its last president was assassinated back in 2021. The Philippine Coast Guard says one of its ships was damaged by a water cannon fired by a Chinese Coast Guard vessel. The incident took place in a disputed area of the South China Sea. China also targeted another Philippine government ship. The Chinese Coast Guard said on social media that it had expelled the two ships for, quote, intruding. The Biden administration will move to reclassify marijuana as a lower risk substance. That's according to a person familiar with the plans. Currently, the US federal government lists cannabis as a highly addictive Schedule 1 drug on the same level as heroin. If the approval process is successful, marijuana will move down to a Schedule 3. Most states already allow medical use of cannabis, with almost half also permitting recreational use by adults. Returning to one of our top stories now, pro-Palestinian demonstrations on university campuses across the U.S. More than 1,000 people have been arrested so far across more than two dozen campuses. At Columbia University, the epicenter of this movement against Israel's war in Gaza, one group began occupying a campus building overnight. The school is now threatening expulsion to the students involved. And at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, a CNN crew witnessed police turn physical as they push back protesters. Well, Gran Steinberger is the head of the Hillel Foundation at the University of Wisconsin, and he spoke to CNN a few hours ago about how he sees the changing nature of the protests.
How do we engage in civic education? How do students show their right to free protest and to protest in an appropriate manner? So protest is one thing, and it's a great cause, and we support and have participated in all sorts of protests. But the line has changed with the creation of an encampment and with tension and heightened energy that is creating for an unhealthy climate for Jewish students.
Well, I want to welcome now one of the student protesters here in Atlanta. Janaki Radhakrishna is a student at Emory University. She was arrested last week defiantly singing a gospel anthem as police carried her away. Janaki is now facing charges, and to be clear, we can't discuss the legal proceedings in any detail. She joins us now. Good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So Janaki, you are a second year student at Emory on a full scholarship studying anthropology and religion. You were there protesting on Thursday. How did things unfold?
Yeah, so on Thursday, students and community members were peacefully protesting, occupying the main quad of Emory's campus. We were giving out food, singing songs, handing out literature when police and state troopers raided the quad. They were using extreme force, pepper spray bullets, and really violently arresting people.
So you join this protest. You have a message. We have heard the chants, disclose, divest. What specifically do you want these universities to divest from?
Yeah, so most universities have financial ties to the Israeli apartheid state and therefore the occupation in Gaza and the genocide of the Palestinian people. At Emory, like many private universities, our investments are not made public information, and that is why the disclose part is so key. But we know there are financial ties. We can make very educated assumptions based on the funding sources that our university has and the deals that we make. And here at Emory, one of the most concrete ties that we have is Emory's investment and involvement in the Cop City project. The Atlanta Police Department works directly with the IDF, sharing tactics of violence and brutalization through the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange Program, or GILE. So our demands include divestment from the Israeli apartheid state, but also from the Cop City project as a whole.
I want to ask you, Donicky, about what you think about how widespread these protests have become, because we are seeing them across the U.S. from coast to coast, but also several campuses in the U.K., Europe, even Australia also joining this movement. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just speaks to the severity of this issue that students across the country, across the world, are willing to put their bodies on the line, their educations, their futures. And I mean, I think if we're being honest about the state of police violence, their lives, I think this generation is saying to the world that we're not willing to accept this kind of violence and oppression, and business as usual is not going to continue so long as this genocide does. So I think that students across the country are saying that if the children of Gaza can't go to school, then neither will we.
And we heard at least one university say to protesters, give us your proposal for how you want us to divest. We haven't heard that from anyone else. What is the end goal for this protest movement?
I mean, the end goal is to end the occupation, stop the violence, and restore peace. But we are saying to our universities that our tuition dollars are not going to fund this violence, that we're not going to be complicit as the constituents of these institutions. And I think that it's really easy for universities to sort of shift the burden to students to determine exactly what divestment looks like. But the reality is that they are the experts, and that there are people whose job it is, who are paid exorbitant amounts of money to maintain the university's investment portfolios. And I think that if universities are confused as to how to divest, they should look to the legacy of the divestments from South African apartheid, from fossil fuels. There's significant documented history of universities divesting from situations of violence. And so I think it's frankly ridiculous for them to ask that of their students.
And just finally, Janaki, you are facing criminal trespassing charges, which were upgraded from disorderly conduct. Will this impact your scholarship? And are you worried about any other repercussions?
You know, the short answer is I don't know. We have seen that universities are engaging in this sort of massive, unprecedented repression. I'm worried, and we're all worried about how this could affect our standing as students and our futures. But any loss that we face is so minuscule compared to what is happening in Gaza. And so we are willing to take these risks because Palestine is worth fighting for. And I think that it's so key to remember that our message in all of this is for the world to keep their eyes on Palestine, and to do everything within their power to stop this genocide.
Janaki Radhakrishnan, we appreciate your time today and for sharing your perspective. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, India's massive election is underway right now, and it is exposing the country's stark religious divide. Prime Minister Narendra Modi is running for re-election as head of the BJP, and he's been accused of using Islamophobia as part of his campaign. India's Muslims say his rhetoric is not isolated. Anti-Muslim speech has risen dramatically in recent months, with most incidences taking place in states that are ruled by the BJP. Our own Rill Ripley is on the ground in India.
In Varanasi, on India's holiest river, the Ganges, Hindus worship with the purifying power of fire. But smoldering religious tensions risk igniting a dangerous conflict between India's Hindu nationalists and their Muslim neighbors, who tell us they no longer feel welcome or safe. We came here as tensions are rising over this 17th century mosque. Hindus say it sits on land stolen from them hundreds of years ago. Now they're fighting in court to get it back.
My community is very much worried.
Longtime Muslim leader S.M. Yassin says Hindus are trying to take over their mosque.
How difficult is it to fight in this in court?
It's very difficult. Nobody is listening to us. Nobody.
Yassin blames India's popular Prime Minister Narendra Modi for mixing politics and religion. Modi's political opponents say he's marginalizing the nation's more than 200 million Muslims.
They are treating us as second-class citizens.
What second-class
citizens? If they are saying they feel like they are second-class citizens, then this makes me happy.
Swami Jitendra Anand Saraswati is a Hindu spiritual leader with views on Muslims many would consider Islamophobic.
In the blood of a Muslim, there is a desire to want to riot all the time.
Muslim shopkeeper Shamshir Ali feels like he's being pushed out.
Anything can happen at any point. That is the amount of hate now. They say leave the country. Where will we go? We were born here. We will die here. This is my country.
A country where violence against Muslims is on the rise. A Delhi police officer was caught on camera last month kicking a group of Muslim men praying by the side of the road. The video went viral. The officer suspended. Another police officer arrested for killing three Muslims on a train, praising the prime minister while standing over their bodies. The worst was in 2020. Violence broke out between Hindus and Muslims in the capital, New Delhi. Dozens of people died, mostly Muslims. It happened around the same time Modi was meeting then President Donald Trump. Even those who survived one of the darkest chapters in India's recent history will never be the same. Nasir Ali says a Hindu man shot him in the face near his home, the one place he should have been safe. He says the police did practically nothing, a charge they deny.
Everyone was feeling unsafe. We can no longer rely on the police.
A court order called their investigation casual, callous, and farcical. 4 years later, the case is still ongoing in a higher court.
Is there justice for Muslims like you in India today?
No. Our only crime is that we are Muslims.
The national spokesperson for Prime Minister Modi's party, the BJP, says people of all religions have the same rights.
Is this a Hindu first government?
India by fabric, by design, by structure, by constitution is secular. India's constitution protects the Indian democracy. No political party in country is strong enough to bulldoze a constitution, to bulldoze the will of the people.
Muslim-owned buildings are literally being bulldozed in what the government calls a crackdown on illegal construction and accused criminals, a brand of bulldozer justice all too common in India. Prime Minister Modi accused of adding fuel to the fire when he used a derogatory term for Muslims at a recent election rally.
Ki ka paisa, ko diya
He's running for a rare third term.
What is the worst that could happen, in your view, over the next 5 years?
What happened, I don't know. But that will be not good for our country.
Many Muslims in Modi's India say it doesn't feel like their country anymore.
Prime Minister Modi has said in interviews that everyone's equal here in India, but then you have that campaign rhetoric calling hundreds of millions of his own citizens infiltrators, and it does raise questions about this globally accepted narrative about India, that it's a nation on the rise with the fastest growing major economy. I had no idea until landing here just how many people on the ground say they're being marginalized under Prime Minister Modi. Will Ripley, CNN, New Delhi, India.
Well, still ahead on First Move, letting men make the first move. The dating app that once had strict rules about who could flirt first is making a match modification. We'll explain after the break.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
Welcome back. We'll call it a case of connection correction. The dating app Bumble created a buzz when it first launched a decade ago with strict rules about who could make the first move. But with internet dating scene changing pretty fast, you could say Bumble is tweaking its online profile. Well, Claire Duffy is on the Bumble beat and joins us now. Good to see you, Claire. So Bumble was quite unique when it decided to allow women to make the first move 10 years ago. Now it's changing, allowing men to do just the same. Just explain what they're doing.
Right, Linda. So Bumble had always distinguished itself by requiring that women seeking matches with men be the one to initiate the conversation. And Bumble said that that helped to empower women, give them more control over their dating life. Now, that's not necessarily going away. Women will still have the option to make the first move if they want to. But women users can also select to use a new feature that Bumble is calling opening moves, which is a prompt that they can put on their profile, a question like what somebody's dream dinner guest would be. They can put that prompt on their profile as an indicator to their male matches that they want the man to make the first move. And Bumble says this still fits with that original mission of empowering women, but now they're just giving women more control about who they want to start the conversation.
So Claire, were women finding it a burden to make the first move? I mean, why the change? And how are these dating apps going? Because they have been around for a while. Certainly this seems like a move to sway more people to give it a go.
Right. So this feature is part of a larger relaunch of Bumble under new CEO Lidiane Jones, who took over from Bumble's founder earlier this year. And she's facing this sort of interesting confluence of factors right now. On one hand, Bumble had a tricky year last year. The company posted a $1.9 million net loss. And so they're seeking to return to growth, return to profitability. At the same time, a lot of single people have sort of soured on dating apps. People are kind of tired of swiping and looking to find more in-person connections. So Bumble is hoping that this relaunch is going to help draw people back to the app and really help people find more successful matches, Linda.
Fair enough. And just quickly, have you ever tried these apps, Claire?
You know, I am happily out of the dating scene these days, but hopefully this really will give women more control, more options for their dating lives.
Me too. My marriage was a result of a blind date. Very old school. Claire Duffy, good to have you with us. Thank you. Well, still to come, Bayern Munich clashing with the 14-time champions Real Madrid in the first leg of the Champions League semi-final. We'll have their result Tuesday night next. Well, welcome back to First Move. I'm Linda Kincaid. Let's turn to sports. In the first leg of the Champions League semi-final, a 2-2 draw for Real Madrid and Bayern Munich. And my friend Patrick Snell joins us for more details. And this was a thrilling match, Patrick, really right up to the very end.
Yeah, hi, Linda. Yeah, Tuesday night, another Champions League thriller. Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, a four-goal classic in Bavaria. Real taking the lead in this semi-final as we jump to the action at the Allianz Arena. Real taking the lead in this one through their brilliant, brilliant Brazilian Vinicius Junior. But Bayern responding very well. Actually, now we're caught up. This is Vinicius Junior with a wonderful opening goal of the match there for the opener. But I will say, Bayern Munich, roared on by the home fans, came roaring back in style. Leroy Sané levelling matters there for one apiece in the Bavarian capital. And then a bit of a clumsy foul there. Bayern winning a penalty. You're never going to guess who takes it. It's Harry Kane, of course. Bayern 2-1 up at this point. Plenty of time for Real, though, and they get a penalty of their own. It's not the best defending, I will say, and it's the South American player, Vinicius Junior, smashing it into the back of the net. 2-2 the final score. And later on Wednesday, I'm sure we're going to see more drama when Kylian Mbappe and PSG visit Borussia Dortmund in the other semi.
I know what you'll be doing with your time, but I want to turn, Patrick, to the US football news. Taylor Swift's boyfriend has signed what is an eye-watering deal to continue playing with the Kansas City Chiefs.
Yes, he has. And we're talking three-time Super Bowl champ Travis Kelce signing a record contract, this is, for NFL tight ends. That's according to the 34-year-old's representatives. Now, Kelce's an 11-year veteran in the league. He's calling it an honor and a pleasure. So what's the contract worth? I hear anyone asking. Well, a sports salary tracker indicating it's going to be $34.25 million. It runs through 2027. That's 17.125 million yearly average, and it outpaces New York Giants tight end Darren Waller. Nice work, I tell you, if you can get it. Amazing year this has been for Travis, no question. 2024 has already seen him win his third career Super Bowl title. And then, of course, is that high-profile relationship with music superstar... Taylor Swift. I recall Linda, after winning that third Super Bowl, he and Swift took a vacation in the Bahamas, and in an exclusive interview with People magazine, the tight end sharing his joy about his current life. He actually said that he's the happiest he's ever been. So I think that's absolutely wonderful. And with that, it's right back to you.
Isn't love grand, Patrick? Good to see. Thanks so much. Good to see you too. Well, finally, First Move, call it a case of being transported back in time in the Philippines. Have a look at these pictures. They come from the northern part of the country where a dried up dam has uncovered a 300-year-old settlement. A heat wave and drought are happening there right now. And exploring a lost city sounds fascinating, but people living there may prefer rain rather than ruins. Still fascinating to explore. That wraps up our show for today. I'm Linda Kincaid. Thanks so much for joining us. I'll see you back here same time tomorrow.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.